Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. And today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a terrorist attack on the worshippers at two mosques in Christchurch, which left 50 dead and as many wounded, and has shocked the peaceful citizens of New Zealand as well as the world, since the Australian killer filmed the massacre and live-streamed it on the internet. We will speak with Spencer Sunshine, a researcher and activist whose research interests include US white nationalism, post-war fascism, and European new right politics, as well as left-wing anti-Semitism. He joins us to discuss the killer's manifesto, in which he mentioned his support for President Trump, writing, quote, "As a symbol of renewed white identity and common purpose, sure. As a policymaker and leader, dear God, no." We will discuss Trump's response to the massacre, in which he refused to condemn white nationalism and tried to dismiss it as a small fringe issue, which prompted the Washington Post to write an editorial calling out the president for his consistent failure of moral leadership. And since there is a pattern of Trump not condemning neo-Nazis and white nationalists, we'll try to assess why he refuses to say these are bad people. Then we'll look further into the phenomenon of what could be called white internationalism and speak with Peter Bergen, a professor of practice at Arizona State University and a fellow at Fordham University's Center on National Security and a CNN national security analyst. We'll discuss his article at CNN, Three Terrorism Trends Converge in Sickening New Zealand Attacks, and explore the three emerging trends of attacks against Muslim targets, the use of social media as a platform for terrorists, and the violent targeting of houses of worship. Then finally, we will look into the international protests last Friday, where schoolchildren around the world walked out of their classrooms to protest inaction on climate change. We will speak with Monica Medina, the founder and publisher of Our Daily Planet, an environmental email newsletter. She is the former director of ocean policy at the National Geographic Society, and previously she served as Special Assistant to the Secretary of Defense, and before that was a Principal Deputy Undersecretary of Commerce for Oceans and Atmosphere at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, where she led efforts on Arctic conservation and restoration of the Gulf of Mexico after the Deepwater Horizon spill. And joining us now is Spencer Sunshine, a researcher and activist whose research interests include U.S. white nationalism, post-war fascism, particularly third position, and European new right politics, left-right crossover movements, and left-wing anti-Semitism. As an activist, he's worked on issues regarding anti-fascism, police misconduct, and prisoners' rights. Welcome to Background Briefing, Spencer Sunshine.
Thank you, Ian. It's always a pleasure to be on the show.
Well, thank you. And of course, you're the lead author of the 2016 report, Up in Arms, A Guide to Oregon's Patriot Movement, which is a collaboration between PRA and Oregon's Rural Organizing Project. So since you're so familiar with white nationalism in this country, what is your explanation for why President Trump seems incapable of condemning white nationalism, terrorism? I recall that President Obama gave a speech a while back where he said, "What's so hard about calling neo-Nazis and white nationalists bad people?"
Trump, it is my belief that Trump sees white nationalists as an integral part of his base, and he wants to continue having their support, and he doesn't want to alienate them. And that's simply why, unless he's pushed to the wall, he doesn't make statements disavowing them. Once in a while, when he's sort of forced to, he'll say, "Oh, yes, yes, they're bad." But only when he has to do that.
So when he said that they're a sort of small fringe group, in effect, that's as far as he'll go. So, but there's a contradiction there. If they're a small fringe group, then why does he need them in his coalition?
He doesn't believe that they're a small fringe group. He's saying that to excuse why he's not going to spend time denouncing them. It's a sort of it's a play to parry the question.
I see. So if you go back and you've been studying U.S. white nationalist movements, including the alt-right neo-Nazis and the esoteric fascists, the patriot movements, militias, et cetera, so Do you go back to Timothy McVeigh? I mean, where did this start? Because there's clearly a thread throughout their literature, and it's all pretty much in the manifesto of this 28-year-old Australian killer.
Yeah, I mean, this stuff, if we just look at the United States, I mean, the Klan was originally formed in the aftermath of the Civil War in the 1860s. And then when it was refounded in the 1920s. Our country has had neo-Nazis for almost 100 years now. In the early 1920s, the first Nazi group was founded in the Bronx, New York. They were supporting the German Hitler's party in Germany. They were sort of like expat supporters of the German Nazis. So the manifesto, you know, which I read briefly, or I skimmed briefly right after the massacre happened. He's just picking up on a discussion. It's basically saying here are the positions that I take within the white nationalist world. So he's specifying that he likes environmentalism, he's sort of on the fence about being a neo-Nazi. Maybe he is, maybe he's not. That he's a eco-fascist, so he tends towards certain currents in the fascist stuff. So, I mean, he's like read all this literature. This guy clearly is a little older than some people. He's not a teenager. He read this literature for a few years, and he crafted the manifesto in such a way so that pieces of the talking points would be picked up by the media, which I think he did a good job from a PR perspective. You know, he put this line about Trump and about its influences and other things.
So when he talks about, though, wanting to preserve whiteness and the white race as though the white people are an endangered species, that certainly smacks of Viktor Orban in Hungary and Alexander Dugin, who's a big influence on Vladimir Putin and Russian nationalists.
He's actually to the right of them. I mean, he doesn't quite say he's a neo-Nazi. Says he might use that. He uses a Nazi symbol on the front of his of the manifesto. There's a this picture illustrating some of his political beliefs. He's actually to the right of them. This some of his ideas reflect an older idea from the 80s called Pan-Aryanism, which was that racists didn't want people white people to be divided by country because they didn't want like white Germans fighting with white French people, and they thought all white people around the world should be united. And so that's more where I think he's coming from. You know, like Dugin isn't looking out for white people in America. He wants a united Eurasian empire to actually be the counterforce to America. And I think Orban is really actually pretty moderate compared to this guy. So, you know, this stuff, the manifesto should be really read as a neo-Nazi. As a fascist. I mean, he says he's a fascist. He self-identifies as a fascist, as a fascist, explicit fascist statement of politics.
But when you say it's about he and others, I assume, feel that the white people around the world have to unite against what?
They think that they are the victims of genocide. It's a, you know, hysterical but emotionally rousing narrative. They point to the fact that the white percentage of the global population is declining, even though in terms of actual numbers, there's more and more white people all the time. And they think that they're going to be terrified of people who aren't white. And they think they're going to be swallowed up somehow because their white people are no longer clearly dominating and controlling the world or even clearly being you know, in the United States, they used to be when I was born, white people were 80% of the country, and now we're about 60, which is still a super majority. But for him, that, you know, and for people of that mindset, it's often called the white genocide theory. They are being replaced, and this is going to somehow result in the end of their own identity or the identity of the groups they belong to, even though that's clearly absurd, but they truly believe that. They believe they're like an endangered species, and that helps whip them up into these emotional frenzies.
And again, I'm speaking with Spencer Sunshine, who writes about the U.S. white nationalist movement, including the alt-right, neo-Nazis, and esoteric fascists, the Patriot Movement, and militias, and anti-Semitism. anti-Semitic currents. He's the lead author of the 2016 report, Up in Arms, A Guide to Oregon's Patriot Movement, which is a collaboration between PRA and Oregon's Rural Organizing Project. But again, you know, Trump praised the Bundys. So that would fit into your belief that that this is an important constituency for Trump, that he doesn't want to alienate.
Trump does not want to alienate them. I mean, it seems kind of counterintuitive because they can't be that many voters. But he has really clung to this position through his whole presidency, that he will only denounce them when his back is to the wall, and he absolutely has to. He wants the far right on his side. He, I think, consciously knows that he is sort of watering down their talking points, but he wants to make sure they're in his corner.
Well, apparently he, when during the Charlottesville demonstrations and the murder of Heather Hyatt by a white nationalist, white supremacist neo-Nazi, drove his car into a crowd, etc., that shocked the nation, and Trump's initial response was equivocating, good people on both sides. And then second time around, he did actually condemn white nationalists. And then the third time, he went back to his original position that there were good people on both sides. So I understand that he actually regretted retracting in the second instance.
Yeah, he did. In Bob Woodward's book, Woodward says that Trump said the second day where he denounced the Nazis, it was, quote, the biggest effing mistake I've made. So he was probably pushed into it by, his daughter or other advisors, because it clearly wasn't a very Trumpian moment where he said Nazis are bad. And then he just sprung back to his normal way of talking and thinking about things.
But again, the White House is, they get this sort of phony indignation. This new press lady was just huffing and puffing about, of course the president condemned it. How dare you suggest that somehow he's encouraging or turning a blind eye to white terrorism? But how often does this have to happen? One, him not saying anything and not exhibiting any moral leadership. And two, how many more of these people who are clearly motivated by Trump to conduct acts of terrorism against Trump's enemies, enemies that he has publicly stated, named? For example, that fellow, the bodybuilder down living in a van down in Florida who sent all those pipe bombs. He sent all those pipe bombs to Trump's enemies. His entire van was festooned with pictures of Trump in adoration of his dear leader. And then you have this more recent incident of the Coast Guard lieutenant in Maryland who had a list of people he wanted to kill, anti-Trump or critics of Trump on MSNBC and in the political world, and starting with Nancy Pelosi on down. So, and a lot of the new congresswomen. I don't know. How does Trump get away with that? I mean, does he? I don't know whether he gets away with it, but the White House still insists that, it's like the famous line in Casablanca, I'm shocked that gambling goes on in this establishment.
So I'm going to, in the New Zealand Shooter's Manifesto, he also starts naming his enemies. He says, to Antifa, Marxist, communists, I do not want to convert you. I do not want to come to an understanding. Egalitarians and those that believe in hierarchy will never come to terms. He believes in hierarchy. I don't want you by my side, and I don't want to share power. I want you in my sights. I want your neck under my boot. See you in the street, you anti-white scum. So, I mean, Trump is just like the soft version. This is the hard, unadulterated version. And then, Trump is the softened up, with mixer version of this stuff. And I think we need to stop asking Trump's press people about whether he's lying or not. He's an inveterate liar. He's a soft white nationalist. The truth is not going to come out of his mouth. And we need to, start treating him that way. The press needs to start treating him that way. I mean, why bother even quote his press people? At some point, we know what his MO is. He's behaved the same way for 2 years now. And yeah, they're all tied together. And yeah, there's going to be more of these attacks. And yeah, there's going to continue to be a vibrant, I mean, there's always been a white nationalist movement in America. Let's be very clear about that. It has existed as long as, you know, as long as America has, and there's been one in the form that we've kind of are familiar with the Klan and Nazis in pretty much the same form for 100 years now. And that's going to continue to be a very vibrant movement under Trump because he keeps playing all the notes of their song. And so all the tunes are in people's heads, and these white nationalist groups are going to continue to try to take advantage of the situation and mobilize either by recruiting or by, you know, having these sort of mass casualty attacks are not uncommon for white nationalists to engage in, and they've done it for decades, and there will probably be more.
Well, I recall after the hideous Oklahoma bombing were a lot of, I think there was like 19 young kids in the nursery were killed, along with, I think, 880-plus people.
168.
That Bill Clinton went there, and Bill Clinton actually gave the right kind of speech opposed to Donald Trump. And in that speech, he condemned the purveyors of hate in the media. He didn't name Rush Limbaugh. But Rush Limbaugh got all up in arms, and a lot of his supporters in the Republican Party, the lawmakers, all parroted his indignation. What about extending it, not just condemning Trump, but condemning these purveyors of hate? I mean, they're just foaming at the mouth on Fox News 24/7.
I mean, I think Tucker Carlson is as bad or worse than Trump. So, yeah, it's a whole ecosystem of people who are spreading racist and Islamophobic and coded anti-Semitic lies. And they all are sort of helping, they egg each other on. There's a harder version and a softer version. And, we need to recognize what it is, and we need to do, what we can to limit the influence of these people, whether they're on the airwaves, whether they're in elected office, whether they're in the streets.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, one of the things that's gotten a lot of people's attention is that the New Zealand Prime Minister has immediately said that we're going to do something about the availability of these kind of weapons, because the Australian shooter in New Zealand, he had a couple of assault rifles and a pump-action shotgun. He may have had more weapons, I'm not sure. And apparently you can buy assault rifles fairly easily or relatively easily in New Zealand. You can't in Australia, and you can't buy handguns, because after there was a massacre down in Tasmania a number of years back, the government, and it was a conservative government at that, immediately had everybody turn in their guns, and they were compensated. But they had a national ban, and it looks like New Zealand may go in that direction. A lot of people here in this country and listeners have noted in emails to me that, how come this can't even – you can't even get a debate going in this country, let alone action?
Yeah, we're going to have – there's going to have to be a change in our culture about that. I mean, I like guns personally. I grew up in a military family, and I'm pretty good shot if I say so myself. But, like, I'm all for having much more stringent gun control. I mean, nobody – you only need an assault rifle to kill a large amount of people. And it's almost impossible to think that he could have pulled these things off without some more like military grade equipment. You know, I mean, if he had just a handgun or shotguns or something, could he have killed 50 people? This country is, we have, the loosest gun laws probably in the Western countries. America just has this thing. It doesn't understand that individual freedom does not equal gun ownership, and somehow they become tied together in our minds. And we need to help untie that. Nobody needs military style assault weapons in their homes. There's no reason for it.
Well, Spencer Sunshine, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
And again, I've been speaking with Spencer Sunshine, who writes about the U.S. white nationalist movements, including the alt-right, neo-Nazis and esoteric fascists, the Patriot Movement and militias, and anti-Semitic currents. He is the lead author of the 2016 report, Up in Arms, A Guide to Oregon's Patriot Movement, which was a collaboration between PRA and Oregon's Rural Organizing Project. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com.
Man, see that we all brothers, not cause things the same, because we lack the same color, and that's gray. Now that's Maine, can't burn his cross, cause he can't afford the gasoline. Now if a Muslim woman strapped with a bomb on the bus, with the seconds running, give you the jitters. Just imagine an American-based Christian organization planning the poison water supplies to bring the second coming quicker.
I hope he's right in the head, I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Peter Bergen, who's a professor of practice at Arizona State University, vice president for global studies and fellows at the International at the New America Foundation, a fellow at Fordham University Center on National Security, and a CNN national security analyst. He has traveled and reported extensively from Afghanistan, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt. And in 1997, he conducted the first television interview of Osama bin Laden for CNN, and his latest book is The United States of Jihad, and he has an article at CNN, Three Terrorism Trends Converged in Sickening New Zealand Attacks. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Bergen.
Hi, Ian.
Thanks for joining us, Peter. And could you call this phenomenon that's manifested in the manifesto of the Australian killer in New Zealand white internationalism, since it seems to have its roots in Dugin, Alexander Dugin in Russia, Orban in Hungary, and in this sort of underworld, underground kind of online of all these neo-Nazis communicating with each other?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting idea. I mean, of course, the people who subscribe to these ideas are not really internationalists in a kind of classic sense, but they're certainly learning from each other and reading the manifesto. Certainly the New Zealand terrorist, you know, admired Dylann Roof and referred to quite a number of other right-wing terrorists from other countries. And I think, you know, in the West, as you know, you mentioned Orban. I think that's, you know, Orban, who's the president of Hungary. I mean, he essentially came to power on a platform that was all about George Soros and his supposed kind of nefarious influence in Hungary. And in fact, Soros had funded an important university in Budapest in Hungary, which has sort of been effectively forced to close down. And so whether you're talking about Hungary or the ultra-nationalist government in Poland or important political parties in countries like France and Germany, such as Marine Le Pen in France and the ADP in Germany, or Geert Wilders in Holland. These were all pretty marginal figures a few years back, but they are now sometimes the ruling party, or if not that, a very important political force in European countries right now.
Well, we only have to look at how Brexit has paralyzed the UK, and it's like zombie politics. They don't seem to be able to get out from under it. It's pretty extraordinary to think that Aaron Banks, whose Russian wife is alleged to have funneled Russian money into the Brexit, he was the biggest donor to Brexit. If there's a Putin connection there, that was a hell of an investment on Putin's part. But I understand that there's a move underway to organize all these right-wing parties in Europe to try and get veto margin in the European Parliament elections that Stephen Bannon is quite active in promoting these. And recently, by the way, I think it was Donald Tusk of the European Union who warned against a coordinated movement amongst these right-wing governments parties in Europe to gain veto power over the EU. Is that something we should be concerned about? Did I lose Peter? Okay, we'll have to get him back. We're speaking with, or we were, up until we lost the call, Peter Bergen, who is a fellow at Fordham University Center on National Security and a CNN National Security Analyst. He was the first to conduct a television interview with Osama bin Laden for CNN, and his latest book is The United States of Jihad, and he has an article at CNN, Three Terrorism Trends Converged in Sickening New Zealand Attacks. Are you back with us, Peter?
I am, yeah.
Yes. So what do you think about Donald Tusk's warning about the idea that these right-wing parties in Western Europe are sort of cooperating, coordinated, maybe Bannon is allegedly to have some influence there. I'm not sure about the extent of it. But the fear is that they will get veto power over Europe in the next European elections.
Well, I mean, I don't know enough about it to know to the extent to which these parties cooperate. But I mean, what is clear is that these parties, which were once very marginal, are now, Geert Wilders was really a marginal figure in Holland, and now he's an important player in the politics there. And he's, made a career out of anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant sentiments. Marine Le Pen, who, of course, runs the French sort of ultra-nationalist party, was also a very marginal figure a few years ago. And now plays an important role in French politics. The ADP in Germany didn't exist a few years ago, essentially, and now it's, again, an ultra-nationalist party, which has an important role to play in German politics. So it's not so much – I don't know the extent to which these parties cooperate, but the fact is that they're all kind of responding to the same thing, which is immigration. And in particular, Muslim immigration in Europe. I think this is a feature of European political life that will go on for a long time. And a lot of these countries, of course, in Europe don't really have, kind of an ideological apparatus to accept immigrants into their societies, unlike countries like the United States, which of course is imperfect, but the American dream has worked well for many generations of immigrants and Muslim immigrants into the United States are no exception. They are past the same average income as the average American. They have the same average education. They don't live in ghettos. The only exception to that is the Somali American population in Cedar Riverside neighborhood in Minneapolis, Minnesota. But that's kind of the exception that proves the rule. That is a group that where the average income for families is $18,000 a year. Only 11% of the population has a degree or graduate degree. So this is that population looks a lot more like many European Muslim populations. One astonishing statistic here is 8% of the French population is Muslim, while an estimated 60% of the French prison population is Muslim. So these are groups that are not integrating well, that are alienated, and there's kind of a vicious circle where these ultra-nationalist parties have grown up in Europe. At the same time, they're in response to Muslim immigrants and who are not integrating, and it's sort of a vicious circle.
Well, let me just quote from your article at CNN, Peter Bergen, Three Terrorism Trends Converge in Sickening New Zealand Attacks. The atrocities in New Zealand highlight three emerging trends in the West: attacks against Muslim targets, the use of social media as a platform for terrorists to share live stream videos, and the violent targeting of houses of worship. And in terms of the houses of worship, if you go quickly through the list here, Quebec City, the Finsbury Park Mosque in the UK, the mosque in Minnesota, which mercifully didn't have the casualties that the killer had hoped for, or the perpetrator. And, of course, more recently, the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, and then some time back, the Sikh Temple in Milwaukee, and now, of course, these two mosques in New Zealand. So that's pretty undeniable, that pattern, right?
Yeah, and I mean, I think, houses of worship were not traditionally places that terrorists would attack. But the rules have changed. I mean, terrorists didn't attack journalists or aid workers in the pre-9/11 era. And now we've seen, you know, attacks on terrorists attacking houses of worship, you know, in the West. And of course, mosques are, you know, also getting targeted in the Middle East, let us not forget, and particularly Shia mosques, which are targeted by Sunni fundamentalist extremists. But, you know, one of the interesting trends here that we saw in New Zealand is, you know, terrorists are not only producing their own material, they're also live broadcasting their own material. And this is sort of a relatively new phenomenon that we first saw in France, where a ISIS-inspired militant killed a off-duty French policeman and also killed his female companion, and then broadcast on Facebook Live next to the terrified three-year-old kid, and proclaimed his allegiance to ISIS. So that was in 3 years ago. And now we saw in the New Zealand case, him, you know, the perpetrator live broadcasting the entire event. And I think that in future, this will just be a feature of other terrorist attacks, where the terrorists will not only produce their own content, they will live stream it on platforms like Facebook or YouTube or other social media platforms.
So in terms of the way we deal with terrorism here in the United States and the focus, it does seem to be on Islamic terrorism. And I don't know to what extent you can make the case that we're downplaying or turning a blind eye to this phenomenon of white nationalist terrorism. Obviously, we've seen it in Charlottesville. But we've also seen it, and every time it happens, when there's a connection to Trump, in this case, he was mentioned in the killer in New Zealand's his manifesto. The White House, of course, gets indignant at any such suggestion. But there have been this fellow down in Florida who lived in a van that was festooned with pro-Trump propaganda. He had an enemies list. He was sending pipe bombs to the very people that Trump himself has pointed out as, you know, not only the press enemies of the people, but he's also attacked specific people, many of whom were on SIOC's list. And the same is true of the more recent Coast Guard lieutenant, who actually had a pretty well-developed list of MSNBC critics of Trump, along with Nancy Pelosi and a whole bunch of politicians. So is this a reflection of an imbalanced focus, shall we say, where too much attention is paid to Islamic terrorism and not enough to Christian, white, nationalist, you know, neo-Nazi terrorism?
I mean, law enforcement is very concerned about this issue and always has been. I mean, going back to the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, which was the most lethal terrorist attack in American history at that point, where 186 people were killed, and there was a kind of whole militia movement in this country, and the Michigan militia and other extremist right-wing groups. So, you know, from a law enforcement perspective, I don't think there's ever been any lack of attention on the right-wing extremists. By the way, a lot of them, as was the case in Oklahoma City, you know, they regard the federal government as an enemy, and they try and kill federal government officials, including police officials. So, you know, I think certainly on the law enforcement side, this is an issue that the FBI is very concerned about. Now, as a political matter, some people may choose to emphasize, you know, jihadi terrorism as the threat, you know, and that's kind of, but that's a political matter. As a law enforcement matter, you know, the Bureau, the FBI is all over this, and has been, you know, for decades. And you know, New America, which is the foundation where I work, the think tank where I work, we track lethal terrorist attacks since 9/11. And it's interesting, since 9/11, 104 Americans have been killed by jihadi terrorists in the United States. At the same time, about 88 people have been killed by right-wing extremists in the United States for political reasons. And then, of course, there's even a little uptick in black nationalist lethal attacks. We've seen people influenced by black nationalist ideology kill 8 people in the last couple of years. So political violence comes in lots of different shapes. And, you know, the United States in the 1970s was awash in political violence, with the Weather Underground and the Black Panthers, and that was largely leftist. That leftist violence has largely kind of disappeared, although not entirely. And the right-wing violence has kind of been a feature for, you know, for a long time. And I don't think there's been any lack of law enforcement interest in this fact, because for the FBI, they don't care if you're radical jihadist or a militant right-wing extremist or whatever your ideological flavor. If you're going out trying to kill people, they want to stop it or solve the crime after it happens.
But is there a connection then to our disproportionate focus on Islamoterrorism and the attendant Islamophobia that might generate, and these attacks in New Zealand, which were against Muslims, and invariably they conflate Muslim with terrorism?
Well, we're in the United States. 9/11 was one of the hinge events of American history. 3,000 people were killed. Understandably, that became the focus of law enforcement. And it was really not a focus of law enforcement before 9/11, with very minor exceptions, such as the FBI field office of in New York or certain elements of the CIA. Very few elements of the government were really focused on this. And, so there was a massive focus after 9/11, and I think that's understandable and necessary. But the fact is that, we know from the figures that I've already cited, that jihadi terrorists are a problem, but so are right-wing extremists. I mentioned, this sort of uptick in black nationalist violence. So all of these need to be the concern of law enforcement.
But how do you make them the concern of the political world if there's a,
That I have no control over. I mean,
Well, you're not ruling the world, neither am I, but... there's got to be a way to have a more. I mean, I'm astounded in our current political environment that law enforcement people, even though the other day on Breitbart, Trump talked about, he gave a not so veiled warning that if things turn bad for him, he's going to activate the military support him, the police support him, and bikers for Trump support him, and that was a pretty scary notion. But you're telling us, in effect, the opposite, which is that law enforcement people actually have a cold-eyed, balanced look at this situation. They don't care what the ideology of the perpetrator or their religious motivation. They just want to stop them. So, is Trump wrong, you think, in exaggerating? Is he exaggerating his support in this world? And what's happening to the American people? I always thought that conservatives in this country were always sort of fairly pro-law enforcement, but we have a strange kind of anti-law enforcement jihad going on here.
My guess is that support for Donald Trump is about the same in the military as it is in society in general. The military is reflective of the society, and I think that the assumption that everybody's a Donald Trump voter in the military is wrong. I don't think he cited any evidence for this. The military, the police are a reflection of society, and I think in general they, tend to be more conservative than perhaps the average. But it's not like there's some sort of universal, feeling of admiration for Donald Trump in the military. And in fact, we've seen quite a number of senior retired military officers, go toe-to-toe with Donald Trump, including Admiral McRaven, who organized and was the architect of the raid that killed Osama bin Laden, and General Stanley McChrystal, who's a four-star Army general, who's been very public about his disagreements with Trump. So, I just think that's the assumption that all military folks are sort of lined up on the Trump side, I think is not true. Leaving aside the whole question of what he meant by those statements.
Well, just in closing, do you think that we can learn something from the way the New Zealand government has responded? I don't imagine we will have anything done in terms of, measures to reduce gun violence. That seems to be a debate that's almost impossible to get started in this country. But after a massacre in Australia a while back, there was a very instant move on the part of the Conservative government to essentially ban assault rifles and handguns nationally. There's some talk of that in New Zealand, but there's some pushback. In fact, a lot of people were surprised that they had pretty lax gun laws in New Zealand to begin with. So, but in terms of the way that that the Prime Minister of New Zealand has handled things, going to the mosques, comforting the people, it is a pretty stark contrast to Donald Trump, particularly his response to Charlottesville.
Yeah, I mean, you know, George W. Bush went to the mosque, the main mosque in Washington, D.C., where I'm talking to you from, the week after 9/11, and said some very clear statements about Islam not being a sort of religion of terrorism, and that the people involved in the hijackings on 9/11 were perverting the religion. So, you know, obviously politicians can respond in a lot of different ways, including saying nothing. But in terms of any, you know, what can get done, you know, there was a moment after the Pulse nightclub attack in Florida by Omar Mateen, in which he killed 49 people, where there was a movement in Congress to basically, if you're on the no-fly list, that you couldn't buy semi-automatic weapons. And I still think that's a good idea. There are only about 800 Americans on that no-fly list. I'm sure 99% of them deserve to be on the no-fly list. And the idea that they can legally purchase semi-automatic weapons makes no sense at all. But, you know, the fact that it makes no sense doesn't necessarily mean that it won't, you know, that, that Congress won't act. And there was some political will to do it after the Florida attack, but it kind of evaporated.
Well, Peter Bergen, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Peter Bergen, who's a professor of practice at Arizona State University, and he's vice president for global studies and fellows at the New America Foundation, and a fellow at Fordham University Center on National Security, and a CNN national security analyst. And he's traveled and reported extensively from Afghanistan, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt. And in 1997, he conducted the first television interview of Osama bin Laden for CNN. And his latest book is The United States of Jihad. And he has an article at CNN, Three Terrorism Trends Converged in Sickening New Zealand Attacks. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com.
He changed his clothes and shined his boots and combed his dark hair down, and his mother cried as he walked out, "Don't take your guns to town, son, leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town." He laughed and kissed his mom and said, "Your Billy Joe's a man. I can..."
In this sacred land, it has seen many hands. It has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old. And now the greedy souls just don't care to know of the changes it will confront. So speak out loud of the things you are proud. And if you love this coast, then keep it clean as it holds. Cause the way that it shines may just dwindle with time, with the changes it will.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Monica Medina, the founder and publisher of Our Daily Planet, an environmental email newsletter. She's also a professor in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and a former senior director of ocean policy at the National Geographic Society. And previously, she served as a special assistant to the Secretary of Defense, and before that was a principal deputy undersecretary for commerce for oceans and atmosphere at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, where she led efforts on Arctic conservation and restoration of the Gulf of Mexico after the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. Welcome to Background Briefing, Monica Medina.
Thank you so much, Ian. It's great to be with you today.
Well, thank you. And I didn't want to overlook what happened last Friday. Obviously, the world's attention has shifted to the tragic massacre in New Zealand. But the fact that hundreds of school children around the world in more than 100 countries demonstrated on Friday and basically urging their parents and the older generation to do something about climate change. And it was a very powerful message. For example, in London, one banner read, "We're missing lessons to teach you one." And in Berlin, students chanted, "We are here, we are loud, because you are stealing our future." That's a real wake-up call for you, me, and everybody else that's over what? 15 years of age or whatever. What was the average age of these kids?
Oh, they were all high school students and younger. Mm-hmm. And they are an impressive force, I think, across the planet. And I think they're starting to get attention, but hopefully they'll keep it up and they'll get more and more attention because you know, those signs are very telling and they're apt. For us, for our generation, this may be another political issue. For them, it's an emergency. It's a four-alarm fire, and they want us to get about doing something about it. No more talk. You know, there's no more time for sort of luxury and policy thoughts and, you know, formulations. And, you know, that's why the Green New Deal, I think, is something that people here in the U.S. are interested in. Particularly young people are pushing for that. I think, you know, most great movements start with young people, and this one is beginning to actually take off because of all these young people. And my favorite sign of all of the ones, and I read a lot of them today, was there are no jobs on a dead planet. I think for them, it's not just a luxury. It's not about, you know, trees and things that are important to everyone, but a little more esoteric for them. It really is about their economic future.
Well, specifically, the protests began last summer, and they were sparked by a teenager, Greta Thunberg, in Sweden. And she gave a very powerful speech at the UN Climate Summit in December and basically chastised all those gathered that they're not doing enough. And she, of course, took part in a rally in Stockholm on Friday, saying it's climate change is an existential crisis that's been ignored for decades by those who have known about it. And she's also been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize, this young Swedish. And how old is she, by the way? Do you know?
I believe she's 13.
13, right.
Yeah.
Well, that would be the youngest.
Very young. She's very young, but she's an excellent communicator and a very sort of poignant messenger, I think, because of her determination, sort of her, you know, her youth, but also just her sort of stick-to-itness. I mean, she's been at this for a while, and she sparked protests across Europe that have been happening. As you said, they started last summer, but they've been happening in greater and greater numbers over the last 2 months, and it's really impressive. But then what she's managed to pull off by inspiring young people all over the globe, as you said, 100 countries, hundreds of thousands of students, and not just in capitals, but in smaller regions in Africa, in the Pacific, in the island Pacific, every continent, across North America, not just in, you know, the capitals in the U.S., but in Montreal and Quebec. It was an impressive thing. I think a lot of us wondered what would happen on Friday. Could they really pull off an impressive showing? And I think they absolutely did. And they brought their parents along, which is really important because these kids are too young to vote, yet a lot of them. But they're going to be of age over the next 10 years, and they are making their parents more aware, which is a great thing. It's a, you know, it's a win for both generations.
Well, some of them made lawmakers aware. The video of Senator Feinstein having a kind of a little bit of an argument with these young kids went viral. And it was sort of, I mean, she's obviously not a bad person, but you could see that she just didn't get it.
Right.
And that's,
well, I think what was impressive is that after the encounter with the students and then the viral video, has gone back and is reworking her own legislation. So I do think it shows that she herself listened, but I think it was an aha moment for everyone who saw it, because those kids were incredibly articulate. They weren't, you know, I think some people thought she was caught off guard. I know a lot of news commentators said, oh, that was sort of an unfair use of social media. But I actually think it was right. These students spoke their minds. They had their facts. They knew what they were talking about. They stood their ground, but they weren't angry and they weren't in her face. And she also kind of, you know, said, well, you have to understand this is a process. It takes time. But then she hurt them. I think eventually, because of the way it rebounded on social media, she hurt them. Now, we'll see what her bill says. It wasn't nearly far enough. The original bill that she had talked about and had been working on didn't go far enough. But all of it is still just a framework. It's an action plan, a list of things that we need to do more than it is a piece of real legislation. So we have a long way to go, but that's the kind of conversation that needs to happen in our country around what do we do. And there's certainly plenty of room for more background briefing and more shows like yours to take this up and to talk about it in a serious way. And I really appreciate that you latched onto it today.
And again, I'm speaking with Monica Medina, who's the founder and publisher of Our Daily Planet, an environmental email newsletter. She's also a professor in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and a former senior director of ocean policy at the National Geographic Society. And previously, she served as a special assistant to the Secretary of Defense, and before that was principal deputy undersecretary of Commerce for Oceans and Atmosphere at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, where she led efforts on Arctic conservation and restoration of the Gulf of Mexico after the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. Now, there was a rally outside the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. on Friday, and students there observed 11 minutes of silence for each of the 1 years, or the 11 years, each year that the United Nations report warning about global warming was issued. And obviously the point is, 11 years later, where are we? And there's no question that we haven't done enough. It's also true, is it not, Monica, since you've worked at NOAA, the window is closing, is it? And haven't we effectively lost 4 years under Donald Trump?
We are definitely losing precious time under President Trump, who has turned us in absolutely the wrong direction. The students at the Capitol were quite forceful in their remarks. The moments of silence were really quite remarkable for their length. It's amazing to be in a moment of silence that goes on that long. It was really quite something. And the Trump administration is doing everything it possibly can to turn us in the wrong direction. In fact, Secretary of State Pompeo was quoted today on Fox News saying that climate change didn't even rise to the top five of the foreign policy important crises, issues, whatever, that he saw, wouldn't even make his list, which in itself was interesting since he'd never even really, he's been a climate denier. So, yes, the window is closing. We have very little time. You know, I think about the families in the Midwest who are struggling with devastating flooding this weekend, and the floodwaters are still rising in a, what used to be called a 100-year storm, but this is the second one in 10 years. So we see it everywhere. It's happening now. The window is definitely closing. But I don't want to leave this discussion on a down note, because there's so much potential as well. And I think that's the other thing that these students highlight, is that with our efforts, if we put all of the, our ingenuity and our determination behind it, we can do things to get back moving in the right direction. We can undo what the president's, rolled back. We can put our clean power plan back into place. We can get clean cars back on track. And, wind and solar keep taking off despite every effort by the Trump administration to put fossil fuels ahead of them. So I think there's plenty to be optimistic about. We can't be defeatist, but we do have to take action now. The students are right that there's no more time for thinking about this. Incrementalism is too slow. We need to act like this is the emergency that it is, and that they see it to be.
So, when you were at the student rally outside the U.S. Capitol on Friday, Monica Medina, did the Green New Deal come up?
Oh, yes, it came up, and lots of students had signs, and there were plenty of people from the Sunrise Movement there. It's definitely on the minds of, I think, people here in the U.S. It keeps making the news. The Republicans keep trying to put labels on it that are going to scare people, but I don't think they're going to stick. I think people understand that the New Deal was successful, and the Green New Deal could also be successful.
Well, you know, there is a lawsuit proceeding in the U.S. courts that I think that should give us hope. It's called Giuliani versus the United States. It's often called Kids versus Climate, because the plaintiffs are all minors, and because their claim is that the federal government has violated the Equal Protection Clause by choosing to expose them to climate suffering rather than take action during the lifetime of their parents. So it would be a very creative and unconventional argument. But what's your sense? Do you think there's some hope that there could be a win here for the plaintiffs?
I think it's a long shot, but I think there are lots of novel theories, and every one of these sorts of cases breaks ground. And this one has made it a lot farther than anyone thought. There's a similar case being brought by a group of fishermen in the Northwest, the Pacific Northwest, who are also arguing that their fishing rights are being taken away because of the actions of large oil and gas companies. There was a city council resolution passed, I believe it was in Toledo a couple of weeks ago, giving rights to Lake Erie, which basically meant that citizens could sue on behalf of to clean up the waters in the lake. So I think there are lots of novel things happening because people are frustrated with the stagnation that they see in Washington. And I think all that's good, because the political movement, we need this political support behind this movement in order for it to really take effect, in order for politicians to know that not only can they take these votes, but they must take votes that will support greater protection for air, water, and take action against climate change that can really turn us around.
Well, Monica Medina, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you again for having this important talk on your program. It's great.
And again, I've been speaking with Monica Medina, who's the founder and publisher of Our Daily Planet, an environmental email newsletter. She's also a professor in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and a former senior director of ocean policy at the National Geographic Society. And previously, she served as a special assistant to the Secretary of Defense. And before that, was principal deputy undersecretary of Commerce for Oceans and Atmosphere at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, where she led efforts on Arctic conservation and restoration of the Gulf of Mexico after the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by half past nine. One more light goes out in the